welcome to the inaugural episode of the Get Hip Cast. Episode one, initial commit, snafu. Today I'm joined by Kevin Lewin and Tom Tarr. Say hello, guys. Say hello, Kevin.
Hey, everybody.
Say hello, Tom.
Hello.
And just to give a little background, we've been here caught in quarantine for quite a few months now, and we thought it would be great to talk about technology and culture, and we'll try to keep this going on a weekly basis and have different guests talk about tech and culture and, you know, things that are near and dear to our hearts. If you haven't noticed, the Get Hip Cast is kind of a play on words. Git is, for those who don't know, it is a source code repository that has enabled distributed development across the globe. And I kind of believe it's we need to get hip and learn how to work in this new normal as we move forward, as people like to call it, the new normal. I prefer to call it today, and not there's nothing new about normal, because normal is a relative term. But we'll explore that as we go through this. So some of the things we hope to explore in this episode and future episodes are things like, what's the world look like today? You know, what are the dangers of fearing tomorrow and trying to hold on to yesterday? What are the implications of protectionism and or futurism? What role will technology play as we move forward in this new landscape? What role will we play? What role will our organizations play? And lots of things around these key topics. So with that, I'll let Kevin give a brief introduction of himself, and then we'll have Tom do the same. So, Kev, why don't you tell us who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
Right on. My name is Kevin Lewin. I am nearly 40. I live in Northern California, near Sacramento, and I've been working in tech since, been experimenting with tech since I was probably a single-digit age group. Been using Linux since I was about 13, and held various technical jobs from system engineer, tech support rep, all that stuff, starting in the late 90s, and currently in a role where I contribute to the sales cycle, a sales engineer type of role, and also heavily work on the delivery of engagements when we have a customer sign on for various services. Passionate about tech, love embedded Linux. I don't know why I'd run Linux on my toaster if I could figure it out. And happy to be here today.
Thanks, Kev. Tom, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. Thomas Tarr. I'm on the opposite coast of Kevin. So I'm on the East Coast, a little bit outside of New York City. But like Kevin, I've been in technology for upwards of 20 years now. So I am north of 40, unlike Kevin, who is south of 40. And similar to Kevin, I am on both the selling side of technology for clients and also the implementation and build out for customers in the technology space. I've been pretty passionate about technology since I was been very young, especially when I had to build my first computer in high school, right up until nowadays, where I love, you know, my job, my technology within my job, but also programming on the side. My passion is really around programming and tinkering with programming languages and what they can do for you. So I've always loved to dabble in that and see how that can better affect our workday environments too as well. So back over to you, Rich.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Yep. And I am Rich Bocanfuso, our host for today's episode and all future episodes. I live in New Jersey, just about 30 miles south of where Tom lives. Tom and I have worked together for a long time. I enjoy all things tech as well. I'm passionate about everything I choose to talk about. And I'm really excited to kind of delve into some of these topics that I've carved out for today's discussion, and how they impact culture and technology moving forward. So let's start with our first, I'll be posing open-ended questions through today's session. And some of these questions could be quite controversial, and I'm actually quite interested in hearing your opinion. And clearly we can see we're all working in this new norm. Tom is conducting a totally separate conversation from what's happening here on the podcast, which we can all see. And I think that's what's interesting about as we move forward in this this new landscape, the way we conduct ourselves and how we become interrupt driven will be unique. And I'm sure as we go through this podcast, Tom will demonstrate that for us in a mime type fashion.
Absolutely.
let's dig in with our first open-ended question. I talked a little bit about the new normal and how I don't like the word normal because it's a relative term. In an era where we're endeavoring to challenge the status quo and invent and iterate and interrupt not only technology, should we not be envisioning a better future and accepting today as the normal, whatever today looks like? Because time spent thinking about a return to normal is really wasted time, because it infers we're living in the past, pining away for what was, not will be. So, Kev, with that, what are your thoughts on this idea of the new normal versus just something different and learning to adapt to what has been an ever-changing, you know, human condition since really the dawn of time? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on the topic, and I think that as much as technology permeates, you know, everything that we do and all facets of our interaction with individuals, businesses, the government, everything else, I think that the new normal, as it's referred to, has minor and major implications from a service perspective. For example, I think people are being forced to interact in ways maybe they never thought before. And sometimes it's convenient. For example, I feel like curbside pickup for your pizza that you get takeout is going to be a thing going forward, even when there's no coronavirus and mask mandates and people are social distancing. Maybe a minor thing, but the technology and the industry has to kind of support these expectations. And the way that people are, you know, interacting with businesses in a virtual way is also going to be part of this, you know, new normal, right? I mean, there's just not going to be as much face-to-face interaction. And I think it's kind of forcing broad cultural adoption of those types of interactions.
Interesting. How about you, Tom? What are your thoughts?
I do agree with Kevin on a lot of those points. And I think from the idea of like the new normal, like and the idea of like what this normal can be, I feel like, hold on a second.
Well, right now, audience, we're experiencing the new normal right here. Actually, this. But what's interesting is, this was also the old normal.
Yes.
There's nothing new about this.
I've been perfectly comfortable with this type of setup for a long time. What I find is interesting with your idea around the normal is the notion that people want to go back sometimes to the older way of doing things, right? And the kind of holding on to that old way because it was a comfortable way, or it was the way that you envisioned it always happening, instead of using something as global and as far-reaching a shift as this pandemic has done, to take the opportunity to say, hey, what can we change? What can we actually leverage as a part of? And I know Kevin used the illustration from a restaurant standpoint, but in the workspace, like forcing us all to work from home, you know, while may seem inconvenient in some aspects of things because you get noise in the background and you get kids that may be screaming and things of that nature, but it also opens up other avenues and other areas of ability to succeed where the old paradigm might not have allowed you. And I think a lot of people in this world want to go back to the old way simply because they're used to it, instead of looking at this as an opportunity to say, hey, what can we change? How can I use this to my advantage? How can I use this to do something different and actually make a change in the way that we do things? And understand that change may affect, maybe a good thing, right? It may actually open up new avenues and new opportunities that you never even thought of exploring had you not been afforded this opportunity to almost be forced into this change. I think just kind of immediately say the pandemic ended tomorrow, which would be great. You know, do we immediately all revert back to the beginning, right? And the way it was, just because that's what it was, right? Or do we use this opportunity to say, hey, let's look at all these new opportunities and new challenges we overcame by being forced into the pandemic, and then see where that actually gives us a new ability to do things. And I think that's where, kind of on a, like as you said, this new normal, which I agree with you, the idea behind normal is just kind of today. But I think we got to be careful in not going back to the normal way just because that's what we're used to, and use this opportunity to kind of say, okay, let's use this and build that change. And listen, there may be changes that don't work, but this is an opportunity to actually explore those changes where we never had the ability to do before.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the circumstance that we're living in right now is unfortunate, but there's nothing abnormal about it, because abnormal would imply it was something that historically hadn't happened before, that was so outside the realm of our ability to conceptualize it that it would be abnormal. But the reality is, it's easy to conceptualize things like viruses that have, you know, have massive impact on society because they've happened over and over and over again. So I refuse to believe that this is abnormal. I actually think this is normal because it's happened. It may not happen often, but it happens. And I think what's interesting and what's not normal is potentially how we've adapted to it, because we've adapted in ways, in large part because of technology, that would have been very hard. Like, you know, restaurants, while they're struggling in an unfortunate circumstance, without Grubhub, they'd be struggling significantly more, right? So technology will open new paradigms for new types of entrepreneurs to emerge. And, you know, because Kevin had talked about the pizza delivery shop, you know, ultimately the most costly part for any restaurateur is the brick and mortar facility. You know, it's the reason why the food truck business took off. So when you take and you look at what tomorrow might look like, I think there's a whole new wave of opportunity that enters the marketplace if we don't try to hold on too tight to what the world used to be like. And I think that kind of holds true for pretty much everything in life. But those were, I think, some great insights. Tom, just to redirect, what do you think, because we'll cover this, I think, in a little bit, from a culture perspective, what do you think the future holds for people who do reverse the course of action? If the pandemic, you know, everything's great, the pandemic's gone tomorrow, all of a sudden we have some magic pill that wipes out the virus, we don't need to worry about it, and organizations revert back to the way they were 6 months ago. All the same rules, restrictions. What do you think the landscape looks like for the knowledge worker going forward?
I think you're going to see a lot of pushback, because unlike this being a hurricane or something where it's a very finite short period of disruption, like Hurricane Sandy, great, we were all in some sort of weird state for a week, 2 weeks, maybe three at the most, right? Here it's been 5 months, 6 months now, and even at 6 months, I think habits start forming and comfort levels start building with people. Like they've gotten used to now whereas in February or March, it was, okay, I got to figure this out, got to get used to this. Oh God, it's kind of weird. Right now it's the normal, like now it is your normal. Right. And so now if you take day one and say, okay, now revert back. Right. I think you're going to that the people that have built successfully your work environment to and your mentality to work in this mode, right? They're not going to want to just switch back, and they're going to want to switch, you know, they're going to push back, and they're going to say, listen, I'm X more productive now than I was in the traditional brick and mortar office world. Here's proof of it, right? And while there are some challenges, here's how you overcome these challenges. Why are we reverting back? And I think by actually giving us a 6 months of almost a demo, right? You're now given, you've empowered people to say, listen, it can work. It does work. And again, it's not for everybody, obviously, but you're going to get people to now say, okay, great, you can revert back, but I still want to stick with this process and the way we're doing now. And you're going to get that workforce that says, okay, great, you can revert back, but this is where I wanted, this is how I want to structure my day, so to speak. And I'll work with you on a hybrid model, or I'll work with you on exceptions to the rule. But after 6 months now, I've kind of, we've shown that you can go this route. And why go back? You know, almost like if the pandemic ended today, company manager or building manager, you prove to us why we need to shift back to the other way. You know, so, you know, it's almost on them to say, okay, make it so we want to come back. Right now, no one's, for the most part, most people are going to say, why do I need to go back? And they have to now say, they can't just say open the door and say everybody come back into work, right? It's going to be open the door and tell me why I need to come back into work. You know, why do I need to get out on a, you know, 2 hour commute, sit in an office and a 2 hour commute home, right? And whereas we've shown over the past 6 months that work continues as normal, right? Without all that.
Yeah, Kev, I know we as a team, we've had to be, I kind of view it as, you know, when we were showing up in an office a couple days a week and we had some kind of cadence about, you know, being in an office, it's easy to not be intentional about your interaction with other people, right? You're crushed. You've commuted 2 hours. You get to the office. You're stuck on conference calls for 5 hours. You got to grab something to eat. Then you're commuting back home. You got to return emails. So it's like you kind of check this box of being there, but you're not really there. And I know as a team, during the quarantine, we've spent a lot of time, I think, being more intentional about how we connect with each other. You know, we've done a lot of things, Name That Tune. We've done personal presentations on our mentors. We've done lots of things virtually that for me, I think have opened my eyes to the value of being engaged for 1 hour as opposed to being somewhere for 12 hours. And not being engaged at all. What do you think about that? How have you seen, you know, some of the things we've done as a team? What's your view of that, of those things versus how things were pre-quarantine?
You know, it's really fascinating for me because when we had our virtual kickoff that we normally would go to a destination, usually with gambling or beachfront, always, you know, alcohol, that aspect of the team building dynamic was absent, but the content and the participation on a virtual level for what amounted to some really long days, I actually perhaps got more out of it. And it's not just by virtue of the fact it was virtual. It also, you have to give some credit to the content and the different contributors and the sessions and everything. But the point is that I feel I got as much or more out of it, even though it was virtual, than I would have when we were actually in the flesh, you know, together, socializing, you know, having our physical team building. So I'm not sure it answers the question directly, but it has opened my eyes to different possibilities and also reinforced the mindset of, you know, something is definitely in aspects what you put into it, right? I mean, you can not embrace the virtual interaction and just be convinced before it starts that we're not, you know, together, so I'm not going to get the same value out of it, or you can, you know, really openly give it a try. And I thought that was definitely surprising. And they were very long days, and I feel even more effort was put in because they were virtual. You had to be that much more engaged. You know, you couldn't kind of step out in the hall and do your own thing. I mean, you really had to be present. And I thought it was a great kickoff this year.
Cool. Okay. Next question, Tom, we'll start with you since we started with Kevin on the first question. So next question is really, I'm going to kind of take what I had formulated as really three questions and try to boil it into one question, right? So, obviously there's a lot of schools of thought on, you know, work from an office, work from home or anywhere. And then what I think a lot of corporations, especially those who've traditionally had an office culture, are trying to meld to, which is a hybrid work environment. There's lots of thoughts. There's lots that's being written on these things. And one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is what an organization's natural bias is in a situation. And what I mean by that is, There are lots and lots of situations where corporations have traditionally had an office culture. They've had to shut down the office culture, and now they literally overnight they went from an office culture to a full work from home culture. Now, what's interesting is that might not be the culture, but the expectation is in order to stay in business, you have to perform exactly the same as you did in the office at home, because there are not many corporations that can afford a 50% performance hit and survive. So one day we flipped the light switch and we said we had an office culture. Everyone in the office performing at this level, whatever that level was. Now no one can come to an office. Everyone's working from home. And our hope is we can report to Wall Street or whoever our shareholders are that our performance is the same. And in technology, we kind of see that everywhere, right? Like, technology hasn't been hit as hard as some other industries. And, you know, in some cases, people are saying it's harder to operate from home in other cases. But ultimately, we want to have our performance, the ultimate metric, which is, you know, shareholder return or revenue or gross profit or whatever metric you want to use. We want to try to hold that line, which in general means that everyone needs to perform at the same level. Now, my question is, while there's a desire, and clearly in a lot of cases we've done it, we know we've done it, right? Our performance hasn't really suffered because we've moved to a work from home model. The desire is, though, culturally, if you came from a office culture, you kind of want to go back there. Back to your point, Tom, on the, you know, what normal is kind of what used to be, right? So to return to normal, you have to return to yesterday. So my question is, as we do that and organizations start to hedge and say, we have a hybrid, the choice is yours. The office is open. You can come here or you don't come here, but the leadership of an organization decides to return to an office. Does that demonstrate a natural bias that says, if you're a person who doesn't return to the office and you're working in an organizational culture where the leadership is in the office every day, is there a natural bias that says you can't progress within that organization because they've disclosed that to you through their actions? And in turn, does that flood the market with talent that normally wouldn't be in the market to move into an organizational culture that fits them better? Tom, question, open-ended question for you.
Okay. So I think no matter what you can say or do or put down on paper or make official policy, I think there's going to be a natural bias to if leadership is in an office and the worker bees are remote, then, or most worker bees are remote, but some come in, obviously there's going to be some bias towards the ones that are there, right? Because obviously, you know, there's human interaction going on. There's, you know, maybe conversations around a water cooler that don't happen, that happen, that the remote people are not aware of, right? So I think there's always going to be that level of, no matter how many times you say it, that everything, you can do whatever, work wherever you want, there's always going to be that feeling. Now, I think it's up to the individual worker to say, you know, what's priority to that person, right? Is it fear of missing out on conversations that may be happening in the office? Or, hey, you know, I'm working from home, I'm productive, I'm getting my job done, I'm doing everything that's asked of me, and then some, I'm comfortable. You know, it almost becomes a confidence of that person that's working from home to say, I can do this, I can work from home, this is, I see the benefits of it. You know, I don't need to you know, be in the office just to kind of say, show myself because I'm confident in what I'm doing. I do feel going forward, though, you know, that hybrid model is going to have to expand and get better defined, right? I think there is going to be some need for in-person collaboration, especially in the sales world, when you're meeting with customers. But again, that gets into a whole nother tangent of where true technology sales is going as far as face-to-face type stuff. But within the overall office culture, I think if management makes a decision to say, hey, we're going to be in the office, but you have a hybrid world, you're trying to force people to then come back in, whereas management should say, okay, we're going to be hybrid too. We may be in the office sometimes, but we're going to be working from home. We buy into this hybrid world. If management basically says, I'm not going to buy into the hybrid world for us, but it can be for you, then it's almost like there's two different sets of rules, and then that becomes very, very difficult to balance, right? Especially, you know, if you're trying to, again, move up, trying to, improve your standings within the company, you almost then feel the need to have to come in just for that fact, in which case workers are not going to be happy. So, yeah, I think that's going to help. That's going to drive the knowledge workforce to say, okay, I may want to work for a company that's completely 100% remote, both management and workers, right? And start. That may not happen right away. You know, it's not going to be like, oh, okay. But over time, I think now that everybody's kind of seen the worker can do the work at home and still be productive and still keep the bottom line going, people are going to start saying, okay, if culture starts shifting back to the office for reasons that person doesn't believe in, then you're going to start seeing shifts to companies. And by the way, a lot of the startup companies now are going to, all those startups that always have been remote and have promoted being remote, they're going to start getting that influx of talent because they can provide that and be comfortable providing that purely remote world. Whereas the traditional office culture people are going to start seeing that degradation of the workforce then. If they say they're hybrid, but they're going to be in, then they're almost trying to force it. That makes sense?
Yep. Yeah, and I think it was, Tom, I think you and I, we maybe like 12 years ago, did we go to that aviary presentation at the 92Y together in Manhattan?
I remember the aviary guys. Yep.
Yeah. I remember being at that aviary presentation and with a bunch of other startup founders and the guy from aviary who then later sold to Adobe, him talking about building his company. And this was 12 years ago, building his company globally, right, with developers in Turkey and, Singapore and across the globe with zero brick and mortar, and how what they built and the pace they moved at would have been nearly impossible following traditional rules. And that was 12 years ago, right? And then you look at companies like Git that have never had brick and mortar buildings, right? And clearly there's a belief around Git and the founding of Git that says, our goal is to enable the distributed workforce to collaborate in a much better way, in a new and differentiated way, and basically disrupt, a market. I mean, all of us have used source code repositories and revision control systems, which GitHub, totally disrupted. I mean, it displaced every revision control system. Like, no other revision control system exists anymore. And they did it without an office. So this is clearly possible.
Yeah, and to take that one step further, I mean, by mentioning Git, you brought up the idea of, the open source paradigm has proven that purely remote forces can build something useful, productive, effective, and maintain some product. The open source community has proven that you can do it, right? It's not like this is an unknown entity, and just the fact that, look at all the open source tools that everybody uses nowadays. Not one of those was built by a company with an office, right? And it's been maintained. And I know there's pros and cons to open source, but that's a proof that, listen, a purely remote force can do some pretty incredible things that you don't need to be in an office for.
Yeah, Kev, let me ask you kind of a fork this, to use our Git lingo here, let me fork this conversation in a slightly different direction. you know, we're talking about the workforce and some of the things that are happening around organizational culture and work from home, work from anywhere, hybrid workforce. I think in a lot of cases, and there are some cases, there are certainly a need, and I know we've done it on our team, there's certainly a need for a place for people to cluster, right? And I don't know whether that, well, we can call that an office, we can call it a Starbucks, we can call it whatever, right? But hiring people with geographic density or proximity is valuable, especially when you're hiring a younger workforce, right? Where you need peers to bounce ideas off of, that kind of helps your growth path pretty significantly. Then we look at, as you know, as we get older, you guys kind of mentioned your ages, right? 40, over 40, getting closer to 50 with each passing day on my end. So the idea of flexibility, because we all know as we get older, right, we have children, we have sick parents, we have different things, and our living circumstance may not be, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago or 30 years ago, we may not have bought a house down the street from our parents. So the ability to pick up, once we've already kind of solidified, pick up and move and move to a different geography because a company wants to hold on to those knowledge workers. I think that's something I think we're seeing pretty heavily, right? Especially if we look at the San Francisco market, the New York City market, there's a mass exodus happening in those geographies right now. And when you look at those geographies, if you're a company that built your team in San Francisco, like you can't afford to lose all those knowledge workers, right? So do you look at that as an opportunity to lower your payroll cost? Hey, you're picking up from San Francisco and you're moving to Nevada. Like your cost of living is going down. Maybe you're moving back home to be near your mom and dad. Like that, is that worth a 20% pay cut? Yeah, probably is. 100% it is. So does a company look at that and go, we value you as an employee. We see an opportunity here to lower our payroll cost. We see an opportunity to go chase talent in geographies that we never thought about doing before because we know this remote work thing is working. Is that something we'll see kind of going forward, do you think, Kev? Is it something where we'll see companies adopt this as a positive thing where people can move, they can lower payroll costs, they can retain that great talent, they can recruit new talent in geographies they weren't in or where they don't have a brick and mortar facility? Do you think that's something we'll see a lot more of going forward?
I think that from the aspect of the businesses not wanting to maintain these large offices in, you know, urban centers like San Francisco proper, I think we're going to see a lot more of them realizing that the infrastructure and the maintenance and everything else is perhaps not what they need to attract the latest talent, right? I remember I was at a customer not too long ago, and they had a really nice cafeteria, not similar to, you know, very gourmet, organic, everything else. And they all had a meal card, you know, they get a certain allocation per day. They literally would never have to buy food if they just wanted to budget appropriately. And I was told, you know, that's kind of table stakes for the area. And so when you see kind of these, I think it's a direct parallel to a benefit like living close to your parents or something like that. The whole cost of living payroll thing is to me kind of different, only because I feel as if different markets try. Like I was talking to a gentleman who lived up in Marin, and he's like, "Oh man, it's hot, and we don't even have air conditioning." Well, here it's like you got to have air conditioning, and if you don't have solar, your bills probably in excess of $500 a month right now because it's 110 degrees all day and we're working from home. I can't, you know, my family can't go walk around at the mall and me go into the office and the house can be, you know, 85 degrees inside. So there's a couple different aspects to that, but I do feel hopeful that businesses will adopt more of a remote culture because I do feel it promotes productivity And one other thing that's maybe interesting, I was at a major communications provider in the Midwest, and they had expressed, you know, hey, we can't attract, you know, talent to the Silicon Prairie, right? They referred to it as nobody wants to move out there. And with remote work being more embraced and businesses eliminating their bias on remote workers and where people are physically located, I think it's a big shift, and I think it's a positive one.
All right, cool. All right, we're in the home stretch, and some of these questions are a little redundant, kind of like a personality test, because we're trying to like dig into this organizational culture thing. But so this is from a personal perspective. How important is organizational culture, and do you think by and large has quarantine impacted organizational culture in a positive or a negative way? Tom, we'll start with you.
I think the answer to that question depends on how your culture was doing before the pandemic started. If you have a group, you have a team within an organization, or just the organization itself, that has a good team focused culture, I think those teams adapted very well to a immediate switch to a remote workforce, especially if they've been doing remote. Our team has been doing remote for a long time. It's a pretty easy transition. But even teams that maybe did not do remote very often, but like were very team focused, team goal focused, everything centered around the overall success of the team itself. You have groups where it's a much more of an individual, goal-oriented type thing. I feel culturally that's hard to then shift to a remote model, you know. And I, you know, sales is a good example. Again, I'm not in traditional sales, so I don't want to say that I know all the ins and outs of it. But just, you know, we're happy hours and you know, meetups and things where that helps drive your business are a prominent factor of your business and how you build your culture within your team. And then all of a sudden you don't have that, right? And all of a sudden you have to shift to like, okay, virtual meetings and things where you don't normally can do as much just chit-chatting around and socializing. I feel like from a team standpoint, that culture will suffer more, right? And that will have a tough time adapting to an always remote workforce. Not saying that they can't adapt, they can't pivot, but I feel like there's a lot more effort, and that's where a lot more effort at the management level comes into play to then help really drive the changes that need to happen from a cultural standpoint for those type of teams. A team that's already doing a lot of remote work, either partially or almost full-time with a lot of members full-time remote, I feel like management-wise has to do a little bit less. You know, they don't have to shepherd as much of that cultural change, maybe just tweaks in here and there, like, hey, let's make sure we get together every so often and just, you know, do fun things or remotely or things of that nature. But overall, it's easy to kind of keep that team culture together because it's already, you have a foundation that's been built on it. Whereas ones that are built on in person, always doing things in an office, always, you know, on an individualistic basis, you know, that you're hitting your goals and stuff, that may be harder to then shift to a remote one. And then it relies then on management to really help drive that cultural change that needs to happen for a remote workforce.
Cool. Kev, how about you? Anything to add to that?
I agree, but I also think we need to be careful to associate a necessary like relationship between culture and togetherness and physical presence, right? Only because I think it's real easy at an individual level to say, oh, well, you know, this person's out, you know, they're our only person out in Atlanta, so, you know, they're just kind of out of the fold. Whereas really that's just more of a mindset than a reality. If we want it to be one, that's all. But I also agree with Tom that, you know, it is nice to socialize, and I do have relationships that I want to maintain in a very personal way. That is hard. So like on our same team, it's real easy for me to get on a video call with another team member and you know, interact and increase rapport. With a customer, it's a lot harder to say, hey, you know, let's video chat and sync up, as opposed to maybe, hey, let's go out and have dinner, or can I come into the office and, you know, hang out and give a presentation or something. So I think that's significant.
That's a great point. Do you think that, I know, and you know, Tom and I been together for a long time, and back when we had a 5-person team, 6-person team, 7-person team, we used to spend every Friday on video conferences. Like we'd work from the office Monday through Thursday, and Friday morning we'd log on to video and we'd sit on video, literally, you know, 6 people tiled on a screen on a video conference all day long every Friday, because we had this office culture, and we kind of brought that office culture. And this was, I don't know, Tom, how long ago? 10 years ago, right? So we brought that office culture into the remote work culture, which was, let's just do a video and it'd be like we're sitting next to each other. And I think what was interesting was while today we're in this world where we video a lot, you know, as a team, I think you're right. I think people still have an aversion to sitting on a video call. I mean, it's amazing to me how many people jump on a video call, Teams or Zoom, and the camera's not on. And it's like, okay, it kind of defeats that. I'll just call you on the phone. Like the connection will be better. Like that's kind of where my head goes. But to me, I remember when we used to video all the time, that was almost like when those Fridays were the days I made the shift from, why am I sitting in an office where I only talk to one person? But when I'm on these video calls, I'm way more engaged. Like somehow I'm more engaged on these video calls than I am in person.
Yeah. And I think part of that is that was our evolution of going more remote each time, like embracing the remote culture back when it really wasn't being embraced at all. Right. And I'm not going to say we were ahead of our time, but we were definitely exploring that avenue before it was really something that was even in people's vernacular. Oh, I can work remotely all the time. Okay, great. And I think that was part of our maturation process of growing that knowledge of doing it. Because, you know, as we're doing it, video chat, you know, a lot of times we did video chat just because we wanted to, and honestly, there wasn't a lot of communication going on. It was basically just like kind of seeing things and making, you know, and kind of visually keeping you focused, right? Because we were just starting out doing remote. And for a lot of people, there's a learning process on rethinking your brain and basically saying, okay, this is how I'm gonna dedicate myself to being my work remotely and not be distracted by the TV or the kid or this or that. But now I feel like that was part of almost like a training session for us to get to that point where now we can go forward. Now, when we had to go more and more remote, it was actually a very easy switch for the team because we were all, most of us were very up to speed on almost that thought process. But I think there's a huge part of the work culture that when they went remote, they never had that kind of training. So it is that almost like retraining of the mind to say, hey, this is how you have to start thinking about things remotely. You know, you have to be very reactionary. You have to be like on top of things. You have to be very responsive to things because people want to make sure you're available. You know, it's very quick to say, okay, if you don't respond to a text or a Slack message or something, people are going to be like, well, what's that person doing? Right. You know, whereas in the office, you can probably see them being that way or on a video chat. And so I think that for us, at least, that helped us really mature to that point where our team switched to remote very quickly.
Do you think, Kev, people are still reluctant to get on video conferences? Like, I mean, I know there's a level of comfort that our team has with each other, right? So getting, you know, jumping on a video conference when you got a blanket on your legs and you know, you haven't quite gotten through that shower yet, is easier, right? Because you've already broken down those barriers of like what professionalism is supposed to look like, right? What being professional, what the normal definition of professional, to use that word normal again. But a reality is we're techies, right? Like the definition of normal is like, I don't know, would you rather have someone in a suit and tie who takes, you know, 5 days to fix your problem or someone who hasn't showered in 3 months and takes 5 minutes? I mean, I'll take the no shower and Jolt Cola every day of the week, right? Because that person clearly has knowledge that I want to tap into. And I often say, listen, knowledge takes time. So the more time you spend sitting in front of that computer, the better you are. That comes at a cost of other things. And in some cases, if you're working a 15-hour day at home, you might wake up at 6 a.m. and you might have a baseball hat on and a, you know, a t-shirt, and you might have time for these other things that we've quote unquote defined as what normal professionalism is. But I think that's easy when we know each other. It's interesting to me, the point you brought up around not being able to connect with customers in the same way. And do you think that'll change?
I do. I mean, I think that there's, and part of that I think is organization specific, right? Where you have, like, I have a customer now that I'm not sure they're essential in the traditional sense, but there's a huge emphasis for them to be in the office, and many of them are in the office from what I understand. If not everybody that was before the pandemic, although they are completely enabled, you know, to work from home, they don't have an expectation that I come to their office, but they're all in the office. Likewise, other customers, you know, they put a lot of value on that FaceTime. They want to see you in the flesh, and I'm not sure that the video conference is a substitute, you know, in their mind. And I do think it's really interesting. And I speculate that some people, they make a game time decision at the start of the meeting, you know, should I turn on my camera? And it's not a very monumental decision from them. They just think, nah, don't need to do that. And join with audio only. But I do think that it's a tool that, you know, can be leveraged. It's nice to see people's body language, and I believe it's beneficial to have the another dimension of the interaction.
All right, I'm going to ask you, put you on the spot and ask you a tough question. If you had to gauge on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most engaged and 1 being the least engaged, if you had to take a guess, on aggregate, and I'm not saying this is a blanket rule for every person, right? Where would you put the average for people who turn on their cameras versus the, and I'm talking about not a 2 minute phone call, you know, a 1 hour video, a 1 hour conference or meeting that takes place virtually, those who turn their camera on versus those who have their camera off? Where do you put engagement on a scale of 1 to 10? And I'm asking engagement, no camera on, 1 to 10, engagement camera on, 1 to 10.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's question is almost about generally the delta, right? So let's just say that the person with their camera on is at a 10. It's almost as if the highest you could get to without the camera on would be a 9. Because you're not offering your own.
That's too safe of an answer. Dimension. Wait, you went way too safe. I'd be very politically correct to answer there, Kevin.
Thank you.
But I mean, but would I mean, if you, okay, let me ask the question in a different way. I asked you in a different way, Tom.
Okay.
If you had a team, if you had 5 people on a conference call,
yes,
and you spoke for 5 minutes and all 5 people had their camera on, and you went back and asked all 5 people a question from what you had spoke about for 5 minutes, what percentage of those people would be able to answer you versus five people who didn't have their camera on?
I'd say... Okay, so I would say if your camera's on, you're more likely to... I'd say you... Like, twice as likely to regurgitate whatever you're trying to say. I will say this, though. The camera does add a level of distraction. So a five-minute call, you turn on all your cameras... 4 minutes of that call is talking about whatever's going on in the background of somebody's call, and you're just like, you can't get to the point of the call, right? So I there is a level of distraction, though, that I think the camera actually adds to certain calls. I will say this, if you are the primary speaker of the call, like say you are running the call and you are giving a presentation on X, right? You should have your camera on, you should be presenting. I feel if you're the, if you're simply a listener, right? Having your camera on is irrelevant. That's more of an irrelevancy of if you're going to pay attention or not. I think that goes then bodes to the person itself. But I will say, if everybody has their camera on, all of a sudden you end up talking about the if somebody's sitting out on their deck, the weather behind them, or the trees behind them, and oh, what a cool room you have.
Yeah, but that's part of the, isn't that part of the human connection? Isn't that what makes operating virtually feel like standing around the water cooler? Because ultimately, if everything is about a tactical conversation, then yes, you, of course you miss.
I will say the human connection is really based on that first meeting. So you're having a first meeting with somebody. It's a first call. Maybe it's the first call of the customer. If it's a customer that I've chatted with almost every day, I don't really care about seeing them that much. Like, case in point, I speak with the customer every day. It's a Zoom session. Nobody turns their cameras on. We just want to get to the point of the call. It's a daily stand-up. We're going bang, bang, bang. We're talking through our items, and we're moving on to the next meeting that we have. If it was a meeting where we have people that are brand new, yeah, we pop our cameras on. But we've almost gotten to the point where, because of the regularity of meetings and the continuing conversations we have with the people over the course of a day, we don't even want to bother the camera. You know, it's a nice to have. It's a good thing to have, especially for that first meeting. Like, oh, hey, you know, this is what I look like. This is who I am, right? You know, that's the first time you sit down in a conference room with a customer. You have that first thing. And then after that, you're not like hopping on conference call meeting, video meetings, because you know who everybody looks like, right? You have that you do have that visual assessment or that association with that person's voice. You don't have to worry about that anymore. So I think that's important round one. Or if you're the public speaker, but after that, then it becomes just a novelty item almost, right?
All right, that's fair perspective. All right, final question. As technologists, how important is the technology that your organization provides you and a frictionless user experience when it comes to job satisfaction? We'll start with you, Kev.
Wow, there's so many aspects, positive and negative, to that question. I'm excited to get my new workstation. Not that I've had a insufficient workstation currently, but I have worked at companies where they give you a garbage workstation. It's mind-blowing how crappy the workstation is. And it was only allowed to do work on that workstation, like many policies go. As far as tooling, I think it's very important. And I think that the intuitiveness and the willingness to, you know, use a tool as it's best intended is heavily dependent on the usability of that tool. And to be more specific, right, when you have a tool that requires a software interface that requires development in order to create, you know, forms and interaction with the user, that human computer interaction effort is huge in terms of how much that technology is going to be embraced in a meaningful way, and ultimately how accurate the productivity is tracked. So to answer the question, I think it's very, very important. And I think that there's a hardware and software aspect, and I think there's also morale implications as well. And you know, it's interesting, maybe a hair off topic, but you know, I used to. Well, I'll save that for another question.
Okay. Tom, how about you? What are your thoughts?
I think the tools we use should have the least amount of restrictions while obviously maintaining security to be used across anywhere in the world. Basically, the promotion should be all about mobility, right? Our tool set should be about the ability to access that tool, like Salesforce accesses anywhere, open up a browser, any machine, anywhere, as long as you have an internet connection, you're good. If you're locked down to a machine that can only do a certain level of work and that's it, that I feel like that doesn't really foster much productivity. You're kind of locked, you're kind of limited in what you can do. Now, again, there may be some use cases, but even then, with cloud being the way it is, I mean, you and I both have instances in the cloud where we can do a lot of our workloads that we need to do for whatever analytics we're trying to do. But we can do that from anywhere. And that ability to kind of do things from anywhere is something that I think needs to be a prominent factor in any tooling going forward. If you're locked down to, I have the VPN into using a workstation, a certain workstation, VPNing into a certain environment, and then dual factor authentication on top of that, and other, please provide your, this. I feel like that's just gonna limit a productivity and not allow for much growth in that space. So I think the tooling has to be very, very flexible.
Yeah, I agree. So in a world where we clearly spend a lot of time trying to come up with defining what normal is and defining norms. Do you believe when it comes to this idea of, technology and frictionless experience that we shouldn't be defining norms? I spent a lot of time and I think in certain cases there are people who should have to VPN in and dual factor authenticate because frankly those users are not. The user community requires to be taken through a structured engagement model in order to de-risk their behavior because those users have behavioral patterns that are dangerous to themselves and to the organization. But applying that methodology to an entire organization is probably not the right approach in my mind, especially as we move into organizations that have different people doing different jobs. Like I would expect that your network your network CISO / CTO should have a level of personal governance that should allow their experience to be more frictionless than say someone else within the organization who may not have a deep understanding of what's going on. They may not even know what a phishing attack is. So certain people know what a phishing attack is and other people don't. And if you don't know what a phishing attack is, and I'm not talking about taking a training, answering the questions to get through it. I'm talking about like long before we ever got trained on phishing or social engineering, the three of us on this call knew what social engineering was. We knew what phishing was. We knew all these things. Is there a skills test we should almost take that says you fall into this swim lane and you can have this frictionless experience? You fall into this swim lane because you've made investments in yourself and you have a job classification that says you need to be able to do these things. And we want to remove take the leash off and let you run as opposed to everybody operates in the same fashion. To me, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to just have a unilateral rule that says everybody gets this same operating paradigm. And in that paradigm, you need to figure out how to function. What do you think about that, Kev?
I think it's an interesting perspective, but I also think you can't discount the knowledge that one gains from just usability. Like I'll give you an example. I had a relative who sent me a link and said, "Hey, does this site look legit?" it was a shopping website, you know, killer deal, but not too killer. And it could have been legit, right? The certificate looked good. The the site looked pretty well put together. But then you go to the contact us page, and it's like, you know, a Hotmail address and no, you know, physical address. And then you look at, you know, some of the other aspects, and you have to evaluate the holistic kind of experience to really determine, you know, is it legit or not, right? And it takes something that takes me, I don't know, 20 seconds of kind of clicking around and looking at the site. And with that person, they didn't have that same, you know, wherewithal, and maybe they could have fumbled their way through the same evaluation that I did, but might have taken them 20 minutes, right? So I think that what you're saying has definite logic, but the application of that logic is maybe not so straightforward.
Are you more likely in today's world, are you more likely to throw away a valuable piece of U.S. Postal Service mail than you are to open a piece of junk mail?
Are you more likely?
Like, I get my mail, and my U.S. Postal Service mail, 99% of it is junk mail, right? I think that's true for pretty much everyone. I don't open that junk mail. I take it out of my mailbox, I walk towards my garage, and I throw it in the garbage can. There's no doubt that in today's day and age, I am more likely to throw away a valid piece of U.S. Postal Service mail than I am, in my world, than I am to open a piece of junk mail.
But you don't get a virus from opening up the mail. And like, if something looks a little bit like, oh, I'm not sure, I'll open it. I'll open it, and then, oh, yeah, it's an ad, and then throw it away. Like, I'm not going to accidentally open up an email, and all of a sudden your system's compromised. Like, nothing's jumping out of that envelope and attacking me.
I agree. So. My point is, we've all in our brains created a whitelist, and that whitelist for the U.S. Postal Service it's tight. Yeah. Like, don't we think that email, and even to some degree text, is moving towards the same whitelist mental model as U.S. Postal Service mail? I kind of do. I'm always infuriated when I get a message from someone in an email that's like, are you there? Like, you don't have another more appropriate communication methodology to send me a message where the subject reads, are you there? Like, if you're not that evolved yet, yeah, we need to lock you down more. VPNs aren't enough.
I do agree with that. I think I like the idea of the assessment per person. I think that's it's good because it'll, you know, everybody learns at a different rate, right? We've come to kind of decide that within the school structures have all changed to basically fit that the kids learn at different rates and they got to adjust the classes and stuff like that and who's getting taught what. And I think the same thing applies for people working remotely and what they do and what kind of liberties they have with working remotely. And I think an assessment of some kind would be able to dictate that pretty well.
All right, well, I guess we'll see. All right, we've come up. We're a few minutes over an hour. We had planned to do this only 45 minutes, but I was enjoying it so much that we just kept going. We'll get better at this as time goes on. But Kevin, I appreciate you joining me. And Tom, I appreciate you joining me. And I look forward to our next Get Hipcast. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Take care.